it going.
It's red.
Yep. Yep.
You good?
Started, if that's okay. Welcome to the 2010 Rukavina Lecture. My name is Mark Alpino, and it's my privilege to introduce our speaker today. Before I do that, I want to thank all of you for coming. I think you're going to hear a very interesting lecture, and Randy is a very clear speaker on these subjects. So, but before I introduce him, I would like to thank the College of Arts and Sciences Dean's Office, especially Dean Mark Manganiello, for funding the Rukavina Lecture. I would like to thank Eric Schmidt and other colleagues in the philosophy department, especially Kirk Bessner and Ted DiMaria, who normally help organize this. It's been fun to help out with it this year. And I'd like to thank Tom Rukavina for coming, for whom the lecture series is named. Could you take a bow? Rukavina is an emeritus philosophy professor in the Department of Philosophy and long-serving member of the philosophy. Our speaker today is Dr. Randy Mays, a philosopher of science at University of California, at California State University of Sacramento. He has been interested in topics in philosophy of science through his entire career. One reason I know this is that Randy and I were graduate students together at the University of Texas at Austin and shared a graduate student lifestyle for many years together with other graduate student friends. There's a lot of cynicism about graduate school in the humanities these days because it's very difficult, even more difficult now, to get jobs in higher education with a PhD. But I will say that having Randy here reminds me again of what a wonderful time in one's life graduate school can be. And so I recommend it to you as an intrinsically satisfying endeavor, if that's if you're so inclined. I'm also honored to introduce him because I enjoy what many philosophers enjoy in my relationship with Randy, and that is an intimate intellectual relationship over a long period of time. Like many of my colleagues in Redmond, philosophers are people who develop intellectual relationships that take the form of an ongoing philosophical dialogue. We keep each other honest, which unfortunately presumes that without such relationships, we might not be so honest with each other or with ourselves. And so Randy's played that role in my life over a long period of time. Our families essentially grew up together, rendezvoused in Sun River, Oregon for many, many years, during which time each summer for a week we would enjoy family time and also deep philosophical conversations. Randy has been thinking about the problem of explanation for over 20 years. And you'll see tonight, today, this afternoon, evidence of the kind of clarity that a person can develop through applied and rigorous thought on a problem, no matter what discipline. In this case, in the disciplines really of both philosophy and philosophy of science. I'll let him tell you about his talk, and I'll do the best I can to get out of the way, because if I start telling you more about Randy and his views and my relationship with him, you won't get to the talk. So with no further ado, I give you Dr. Randy Mays.
Well, some of you are probably thinking really excellent evidence of the clarity of this discussion is the fact that I've misspelled my university name on the first slide. I just noticed that as I was sitting there. Well, that's great. Thanks a lot. Thanks for coming. I know I can't imagine this is what you do typically on a Friday afternoon. Where I come from, we certainly don't do this. And I'll try to make this an enjoyable experience for you. Also, just so you know, I really put this talk together with students in mind more than professors. That's actually all I'm capable of doing. But hopefully, I mean, the mark of success would be if the students find it interesting and the professors find it trite and stupid. But maybe I can hit somewhere in the middle. What I'm going to be doing here is I'm going to essentially be trying to put a different kind of lens on argumentative structure than you may have seen before, to try to give you a way of looking at how we think, not just about philosophical problems, but actually about normal practical problems in a way that's actually not typically represented in logic textbooks or critical thinking textbooks or certainly in philosophy texts, primary philosophy texts. But I'm also going to be claiming that what I'm saying, the recommendations and advice I'm giving you, and the way I'm describing how things actually work, is something that a lot of philosophers, especially like philosophers from the modern period, really did understand. It's just that it doesn't really come through that well. I'm going to try to put things together in such a way that I can at least motivate that claim. So I don't know how interesting that sounds to you, but let's see if we can make it interesting. So I've written a lot of things up here that I'm actually going to say verbatim, and it's mainly to keep me honest, just to keep me moving, because there's a lot here, and I don't want to spend any more time than we need to. So the central thesis of this talk is that the process of rational inquiry is not adequately described as the examination of arguments for and against competing views. Rather, rational belief revision typically requires the interaction of two distinct reasoning processes. One of these is argument, which we typically talk a lot about in philosophy, and the other one is explanation, which we don't talk a whole lot about in philosophy. I don't take this to be a terribly controversial thesis. It's not original. It's not, you know, rocking anybody back on their heels. I think most of the philosophy professors would say, yeah, of course, that's true. I mean, explanations are very important. Most of you probably don't need to be convinced that explanations play a central role in rational inquiry, but I think it's also undeniable that we philosophers typically both represent and study rational belief formation as the result of argument, not explanation. We don't really... If you pick up a critical thinking textbook, It'll have a little, typically have a little chapter on explanation, and it really is not clear how it fits the rest of what they're talking about. It just seems like it should be there. But the authors really didn't know what it was there for, really. They just knew it should be there somehow. In other words, I think most of us do not really have a clear idea of how explanation contributes to rational inquiry. So I want to try to get clear on this, and ultimately I want to show how explanatory reasoning figures explicitly into some of the great debates of modern philosophy. And that's all I want to do, okay? So I hope you will find this somewhat interesting. Now, what I will call the standard view, a successful argument is one that compels rational acceptance of a conclusion. As with most standard views, no actual person may hold this view. And that's not actually a joke. That's just the way things are. On the standard view, what compels acceptance of a conclusion is A, rational acceptance of the premises, and B, rational recognition of the validity, or in the case of inductive arguments, the strength of the argument. So there's two separate things: rationally accepting the premises and then rationally assessing the validity of the argument. That's quite boring and very non-controversial. This view pretty clearly just piggybacks on the notion of validity. Okay, just as we say, if the premises are true and the argument is valid, then the conclusion must be true. People generally familiar with that notion of validity, right? We also say if the premises are rationally accepted as true and the argument is rationally accepted as valid, then we're rationally required to accept or at least not deny the conclusion, okay? Now, there's a problem. It's a small problem. It's not actually a big problem. You might think it sounds like a big problem, but it's not. Small problem arises for the standard view when we notice that it's possible to rationally accept false premises. Rationalists like Descartes hope very much to show that this was not true. They wanted to try to demonstrate that if we were thinking correctly, you know, using only clear and distinct ideas, et cetera, that we could actually avoid this pitfall and actually become certain of our conclusions through virtuous reasoning. But today, just about everyone recognizes that human reasoning, like human observation, is inherently fallible, right? So you guys might be familiar with the idea of deductive reasoning, and you might know that deductive reasoning is somehow really connected to the idea of certainty, right? Insofar as if the premises are true and the reasoning is valid, then we can know the conclusion for certain. But the bottom line is that it's humans doing this. It's humans evaluating things. It's humans who are reasoning, and humans are fallible in their reasoning processes just as much as they are fallible in their observation. Reasoning is in the end, it's not something that philosophers like to talk too much about, but it's ultimately, in the end, it's a psychological process that we engage in and therefore can screw up. And that will always be the case. That's just the way we are. Now, what this means, of course, that it is and always will be possible to rationally accept an argument for a false conclusion. This in itself does not imply the standard view is wrong. It only means that we're sometimes rationally compelled to accept false conclusions. Just dig it, buy it. That's just the way it is. Okay. The real problem for the standard view can be seen when we consider what happens when rationally accepted conclusions come into conflict. Okay. So I have two conclusions, two beliefs, and they are at loggerheads. They're logically contradictory. Suppose you currently rationally accept the following proposition. My spouse loves me. But now you learn from a normally reliable source in these matters, that is to say your spouse, that she does not love you and that she has, in fact, never really loved you. Okay? Now, this is, I hope I'm not speaking to anybody's actual situation today. All right, I'm sorry if I am. Now, there's a practical problem, if there ever was one. In other words, when the truth is found to be lies and all the hope within you dies, then what? I couldn't resist that because that's from my favorite recent movie, Serious Man, with Rabbi Marshak quoting Gray Slick from Jefferson Airplane. Well, if you're a Freudian, you might say that we either accept the new reality, the fact that your wife doesn't love you or your husband doesn't love you, or we go into a pathological state called denial, right? But in fact, there is nothing pathological or irrational about rejecting new information that tends to contradict previously held beliefs. Are you with me? I'm actually very big on denial. I think we're really too hard on it. I think denial can be extremely psychologically and even medically valuable thing to do. In the case just described, it may be quite reasonable to suspect anything from a very bad joke to blackmail to a sudden brain disorder on the part of your spouse, right? Or you, right? I can't be hearing this. This can't be right. No, no, no. Something's going wrong, right? Those sound like irrational responses, but they're actually quite not only understandable, but reasonable responses into the circumstances given the strength of your previous belief, right? Or even that you are hallucinating or having a bad dream, which again brings us back to Descartes and the evil demon, right? So the standard response, how on the standard view do we deal with situations like this, right? How would a philosopher deal with situations like this? Well, the answer is that we simply examine the arguments, dispassionate examination of the arguments, right? In the given example, we have arguments for contradictory conclusions. My wife loves me. My wife does not love me. My husband loves me. My husband does not love me. Those are contradictory. They can't both be true. We should simply accept the conclusion with the strongest argument. You just evaluate the individual arguments for those conclusions, right? If it turns out that the best the evidence is that your wife or husband does not love you, that's the conclusion you have to accept, okay? Now, let's first be clear that this is not like some sort of wholesale attack on the standard view. I'm a very kind of standard guy in a lot of ways, okay? Let's be clear, this is a good answer for many situations, namely those in which one argument is clearly stronger than the other, right? Those tend to not be the problematic situations. We often tend to not even notice those situations very much. The truly troublesome and interesting situations in life, in science, and in philosophy are those in which arguments for contradictory conclusions appear to be equally good or bad. Okay? The most vexing of these, because they seem to transcend any possible resolution by argument or pure reason, Kant called the antinomies. Okay? Well, as you know, philosophers are not terribly concerned about solving problems in real time, right? There's a long tradition going back to Plato who didn't even think time was real, right? So why would you solve it in real time if time wasn't even real, okay? So our typical attitude in these matters is that we just need to keep thinking on the arguments and in the meantime suspend judgment, which is wonderful work if you can get it. And I got it, actually. Yeah. It's great work. And if you guys may know just that the Wall Street Journal, according to a Wall Street Journal poll, being a philosophy professor is the 15th most rewarding profession in the universe. Yeah. It's actually quite a bit better than that, I think. So But when we're dealing with matters of practical urgency, right, this isn't really an option. We need to make up our mind because action of some sort is required. Okay? That's the real world. That's what reasoning is for. Action is required. I don't have, right, till the end of time to decide whether my wife loves me, because if she doesn't, I got to get a new one. Right? I mean, let's be clear about the function of reasoning. Okay? To be fair, this fact is really not lost on all philosophers. Whether to believe in God, for example, is what William James called a forced option. That it's not surprising, by the way, that it was William James, because he was a pragmatist, right? An American pragmatist who American philosophy was really, for the most part, founded in the idea that philosophy deals with practically urgent matters. And most of our moral decisions have this feature as well. So, I mean, I'm kind of making fun of philosophers in a way that's not really right. So one way of putting our question is, what is the rational response to information that, A, would introduce a contradiction into our system of beliefs? Okay, that was the first point. B, for which the argument is about as strong, for which the argument is about as strong as the argument in favor of what we presently believe, and C, and for which suspending judgment is not a practical option. And that might seem to narrow things down to a very small number, but it's actually the ones that are the most important. Okay? What other rational resources do we have? That's the question. What other rational resources do we have? Now, see, you might have thought that I wasn't going to appeal to a rational resource, that I would make it really fun, especially for a Friday afternoon, and say we've got passion, right? That we've got emotion, we've got something that's like all nice and really wet and juicy and, non-rational, because after all, rationality is not all it's cracked up to be. But I'm not actually going that way. What I'm saying is that rationality has resources that we often aren't really all that aware of, and that we don't really use systematically, and that we could actually benefit from using more systematically. And this all connects to the notion of concept of explanation. Okay. Now, one standard answer to this question goes by the name of minimalism. The basic idea is that how we treat the new information depends on the overall effect it will have on our current set of beliefs. Minimalism is the view that we should do whatever allows us to best preserve as many of our current beliefs as possible. It's a kind of an interesting view. You make some adjustment that preserves, right, most of the things that we currently believe. And there have been a lot of philosophers, including William James, by the way, who subscribed to that view. Obviously, minimalism is what we call a conservative strategy, right? We're conserving as many of our beliefs as possible. The basic idea is that all things being equal, it is rational to prefer to avoid making radical changes to a functional belief system. The burden of proof is on those who would require the biggest changes. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? Don't go making these big changes to something that's basically working, right? You don't need to rebuild the engine, right? Just because there's a little clatter. All you need is a little STP or something and just keep it going, okay? Conservatism belongs to the pragmatist philosophical tradition. I mentioned James. He has a very nice quote that really relates to this, but I don't want to get too far behind reading this quote, so I'm going to go past it. Conservatism cannot be the whole story, though, and it may not even be an essential part of the correct story. Conservatism actually is probably not the right answer. It is not the whole story simply because there can be many different equally minimal changes. Just consider this set of sentences, just four out of the billions of sentences that you accept. Frank is my friend. Frank deals drugs. my friends are good people, drug dealers are bad people. Okay? Now, that you can all sense viscerally, right, that that's a problem, right? Those four sentences provide a problem, and the problem is a contradiction. That's what the problem is. If you're a philosopher, you say the problem is that there's a logical contradiction here. In fact, there's many logical contradictions here. You can deduce that Frank is both my friend and not my friend, right? That he's both, basically, those of you who are logicians know that once you've got a contradiction in your system, how many things can you deduce? An infinite number of things, right? That's the way it works. A contradiction in a system makes everything provable, and that's a bad thing, okay? So this is a clearly inconsistent set of sentences that can be fixed by eliminating either of the first two claims, actually any claim, right? But either of the first two claims, both changes are equally minimal, right? So that doesn't answer the question. You can make a minimal change, but why would you prefer one to the other? So minimal, that's why minimalism can't be the whole story. Another problem is that conservatism can be implemented simply by always rejecting the new information when it challenges what we currently believe, right? Right? Just plug your ears. In fact, a lot of us do that, right? No, right? Just go away. The problem is it keeps coming back, right? Doesn't always, but if it's robust, well, frankly, if it's true, right, often tends to keep coming back. No, I really don't love you anymore. I'm telling you that. I told you yesterday, and I'm telling you today that that was not a dream, right? And then you've got to produce, and now it's two dreams, or it's a dream within a dream. It gets pretty weird, right? So this would be the right method for infallible agents, but it's disastrous for humans, right? In fact, that's kind of a stupid thing I just said, because if you're an infallible agent, you never need to make revisions of any kind, right? Should be noted, however, that we all operate with a strong bias in favor of what we currently believe. And that's not clearly in any way irrational. That's how we're built, right? Strong bias in favor of what we currently believe. That helps to establish the burden of proof, okay? Anything that's going to change our current views has the burden of proof, typically. Okay. Now, William James' view, which I did not read, has much in common with what has become known as the Duhem-Quine holism. Duhem was a French physicist, and Quine was an American pragmatist and naturalist philosopher. One implication of the Duhem-Quine thesis is that our views about the world cannot be tested in isolation. This is what we call holism. If, for example, you believe that there is coffee in the pantry and you look to find no coffee in the pantry, then on the surface, it seems as if the rational conclusion is that there is no coffee in the pantry, right? I mean, but this holds true only in virtue of a background assumption, namely that you are competent to detect coffee in the pantry, which itself may depend on the assumption that you had your coffee, okay? In other words, we tend to think that we can test our beliefs in isolation, but really, when we're testing our beliefs, we're testing not just one, but, well, Quine kind of overdid it. He said all of them together, but certainly a certain subset of them that are mutually supporting. Okay. Quine, in Two Dogmas of Empiricism, which is one of the most influential articles of the 20th century in philosophy, changed philosophy dramatically. It was really, really extremely important article, said this: any statement can be held true, come what may, if we make drastic enough adjustments elsewhere in the system. Even a statement very close to the periphery can be held true in the face of recalcitrant experience by pleading hallucination or by amending certain statements of the kind called logical laws. So his point was that we could just continue to deny, right, our spouse's claims that he or she no longer loves us, right, by simply adopting all these other, you know, hypotheses that would account for these strange occurrences, namely her continually telling me this, right? Quine did not conclude from this that every revision that preserves logical consistency is as rational as any other. He was not an irrationalist. Nor did he believe that we should make only the changes that would preserve the older stock of truths. That's minimalism. Rather, what Quine suggested is that our primary aim should be to preserve the structural integrity of our web of belief. And what Wilfred Sellers later, another naturalist, and others subsequently called its explanatory coherence. So that's where we have the word explanation eking into philosophy right here. We need to make the changes to our belief system that would maximize the explanatory coherence of our beliefs. Now, when they first started using this word, they really didn't know what they meant by this at all. They had a few adjectives to describe it, but really the amazing thing is they were actually inventing a research program, which has since taken off. This is what philosophers do, by the way, on my view, and in case you've got real, you guys have maybe taken several philosophy classes and still wonder, what the hell do they actually do? I don't really get this. And one view is that they keep inventing sciences, right? That's why we can say often enough that philosophical questions never get answered. It's not that the questions that philosophers ask never get answered, it's that they don't get answered by them, right? They get answered by scientists later, right? We create scientists, and here what we see is still the continuing creation of a branch of cognitive psychology. Now, philosophers and psychologists have used a variety of terms to characterize the elements of explanatory coherence in structural terms, but what I want to focus on here is the sense in which achieving explanatory coherence requires us to engage in specifically explanatory reasoning. Okay? And this is really the main emphasis of my talk. The basic idea is surprisingly easy to understand. First, every proposed resolution to a contradictory set of claims raises specifically explanatory questions. So anytime you decide to fix your web of belief by saying, you know that statement right there, out, right? Then doing that raises explanatory questions, which you are rationally required to deal with, okay? Second, the preferred resolution is always the one for which the best explanations can be provided. Now, I want those of you who may be a little more sophisticated might know that, okay, yeah, I can see this coming. What's a good explanation? What's the best explanation? What does that mean? Excellent question, and we're working on it, right? Nevertheless, right, I'm not going to be unpacking that idea today, right? That's a 10-hour talk, not a one-hour talk. So before we proceed further, I need to take a moment to get clear on what an explanation actually is and how it differs from an argument. This is something, by the way, that you all know, but I need to establish a vocabulary so we can all be talking about the same thing, because questions like, this isn't really what I mean by it, they tend not to go anywhere, right? So we're establishing a common vocabulary right now. We can get at this through a distinction between two different kinds of questions. An argument question is typically a how do you know question, right? How do you know that? That's an argument question. We request arguments when we do not yet accept a conclusion and are looking for a rational basis for doing so, okay? I don't quite believe that yet. What's your argument? You with me? Explanation, though, tends to ask something like, why is that so, right? We request explanations when we already accept something as a fact and are trying to understand why it is the case. So those are two very different epistemic situations. Arguments arise when we're doubting a conclusion. Explanations arise when we've accepted it and want to know what's causing it to be the case. Okay? And by the way, you could have gotten this from Wikipedia. I checked, and Wikipedia has this right. They tend to get most things like this right. You can make this intuitive by just noticing that for virtually any statement we make about the world, we can adopt either an argumentative or an explanatory stance. For example, my cell phone is broken. That's just a random statement. Okay? How do you know that? It won't power up. That's evidence that it's broken. Why is that? I dropped it in the toilet. Right? First question is an argument question. Second question is an explanation question. They tend to produce, though not always, they tend to produce very different kinds of answers. And we are really intuitively aware, typically, of the difference between an argument question and an explanation question, right? If I say, why did you just do that? You know I'm asking for an explanation, right? It's just given. You just need the vocabulary for expressing it. Okay. Note how argument and explanation work together in a case like that. The explanatory step is distinct, but also helps to solidify confidence that your argument is on the right track. Without a model explaining how it might have been broken, the cell phone, you'll be less confident that it is broken. Also, if you accept this explanation, it helps to set a rational plan for action. Okay? So argument and explanation work together in this sense. In a sense, they're working together as the engine of rational inquiry. So remember, this is from a previous slide, remember that the idea is that for every proposed resolution to a contradictory set of claims, you're going to get explanatory questions, and you should prefer the resolution that best for which the best explanations can be provided. So, oh, that was bad. I didn't need that. Okay, here's an example. To see this, consider a mundane example in which the consistency of your belief system is threatened by incoming information. Story. Okay? Your friend Marcy says she'll call you tonight if she's going to the movies. Okay? Marcy doesn't call. She figures she didn't go. Okay? A week later, you find out from your mutual friend Claire that Claire and Marcy went to the movies that night together. Bitch. Right? That's a contradiction when you say things like that, right? Okay? So this problem can be represented as a contradiction that results from accepting three propositions. And from now on, there's no significance to this, but all of my examples will be three propositions long, okay? Just because those are the simplest ones to deal with that still seem interesting. So those are the three propositions that you accepted, right? If Marcy goes to the movie, she'll call me. That's what you thought. Marcy went to the movies, which is what Claire just told you, and Marcy didn't call me, which is what you remember, right? So you got a problem, right? Because this implies that Marcy both did and did not call you, and that doesn't happen, right? There are no contradictions in nature. Actually, that's kind of a stupid thing to say. That's only true because it's a category mistake to say something like that. So this is an inconsistent set of, we'll just stipulate, equally plausible propositions. It can be repaired by denying any one of them. But the question is, which one? Right? Now, you guys can sense that this is a bit of a practical problem. It's the kind of thing that you guys actually deal with on an everyday basis. It has really significant implications for your friendship and for the way you trust people or all sorts of things, right? So this is not academic stuff. I mean, this is just actually real-world problems that we're talking about here, and you could all come up with one that you've dealt with in the last week that has this structure, if that was your assignment. So the answer is that the decision to deny any particular proposition generates one or more explanatory questions. We deny the one whose questions we are best capable of answering. So how is this going to work? Okay. Well, I don't know. That line is supposed to be through that. I don't know why that happened. If this line I meant to actually be going right through that to indicate that we were getting rid of it. Okay, I don't know what the other slides are going to do. It probably got reformatted. So suppose we deny the first proposition, right? We deny that if Marcy goes to the movie, she'll call me. We say, okay, then that's not true, right? Then that just wasn't true, what she said. You know, that might have been why we called her that, right? Turns out that's not true. Now, the thing is that if we decide that's the case, here is the question that arises immediately. Why did Marcy say she would call me when she clearly, say, had no intention to, or at least when she didn't? Now, do you see, and this is really the main point of the talk, it's just going to get reiterated a lot, do you see how that's an explanatory question? Why then didn't she do this? In other words, if I decide number one is true, immediately that question comes to the fore, right? Well, then why, right? Why did Marcy say she would call me? And then all of these answers occur to you, a whole bunch of them, right? She intended to call me but forgot. That would let her off the hook for a little bit. I mean, she should have told me, right, that they went. She intended to call me but decided against it. But why? Again, another explanation question. She had no intention of calling me at all, but just didn't want to hurt my feelings. Well, that doesn't do much for our future relationship. So all of them have problems, right? But all of them are attempts to answer an explanatory question. Then you've got another possibility, which is that she didn't actually go to the movies, right? So you say, okay, maybe Marcy didn't actually go to the movies. And now you've got other questions, right? Why did Claire say they did? Right? Again, an explanatory question, possible answers. Claire mistakenly believes that Marcy went to the movies with her. That's very strange. That means Claire is very, very deranged, right? Claire's the bitch, right? Claire is trying to deceive me and make me think that Marcy is that way, right? Again, attempts to answer explanatory questions. Finally, now I've got the line right, Marcy didn't call me, right? That would be an interesting proposition. Explanation question, then what, right? So you say maybe it's false that Marcy didn't call me, which means maybe she actually did call me, right? Possible, why didn't I receive the call then? That's what we asked there. Another explanation question. Possible answers. My phone wasn't working. I accidentally had the phone on vibrate and didn't hear it ring. Marcy dialed the wrong number. These are just the things that might occur to you. Okay, so you get the idea? You've got a logically inconsistent set of claims, right? It's practically necessary to figure out which one is wrong, right? Which one needs to be thrown out? And the way you do this is that if you want to go about it in a rational way, you would test each rejection, right? You say, well, maybe it's this one that's wrong. Maybe it's this one that's wrong. Maybe it's this one that's wrong. Every time you do that, explanation questions just come out like bats. They come flying out, and you have to deal with those questions, right? That's the idea. That's the fundamental idea of the talk, is that the way you go about resolving these is by appeal to the explanatory power of the theories that you can produce, right, in answer to the sentence that you decide to eliminate. Okay, so the idea then is that we deny the proposition whose corresponding explanation-seeking questions we're best capable of answering. Clearly, what you judge to be the most plausible explanation depends a great deal on beliefs that you have about Marcy, Claire, cellular networks, your own competence, etc. Moreover, your acceptance of any particular explanation is subject to further inquiry, right? For example, if you decide the best explanation is that Marcy did not go to the movies and Claire is simply lying, that's what I think, you would ordinarily not accept this without a further explanation of why she lied and finally some independent evidence that she actually did, right? But it's the explanation questions that get you moving along the right track. Now, right now, I'm representing this as a normative model, right? That's just the way I'm characterizing it. But there is evidence that it is descriptively accurate as well. This is an ongoing area of research for psychologists. So recall that the competing model is minimalism, that we simply make the changes that preserve the greatest number of previous beliefs. This view would suggest that people will typically respond to challenges by rejecting particular categorical propositions and preserving generalizations. A categorical proposition in this context just means a specific statement of fact rather than a general proposition or universal. This is because when you deny or revise a generalization, it will affect many inferences you have made with that generalization. Now, it turns out that many cognitive psychologists are interested in this, but one of the foremost ones is a guy named Philip Johnson Laird, has demonstrated actually that this isn't what people do. He's actually demonstrated that people do not think according to minimalism, and they actually do make the revisions along the lines of the model I just gave, along explanatory coherence lines. Subjects are presented with a problem like this. If the student doesn't stay on task, then she stays after school. Winifred didn't stay on task, but Winifred didn't stay after school. So subjects are actually given a contradictory set of statements, and then they're asked to just tell, right, to decide which one, based on what they've heard so far, they would revise. And they always, in this case, revise the generalization rather than one of the singular statements, okay? And the reason that they will do that is to provide some explanatory coherence. You can revise a generalization, because we know that generalizations have all sorts of what we call defeating conditions or exceptions, right, that would explain, right, that would explain deviations from that pattern. Now, I've actually got quite a bit more on this, but I don't want to press it because I want to talk more about the history of philosophy. Mark, how much time do we have? Okay, good. That's perfect. So let's talk about actual philosophy. So what I've given you now is how this works in practical circumstances. And now I just want to give you a selection. There, it's not a random selection, but it's not a systematic selection of either of philosophical problems that you may be well aware of, that many of you have studied before, but you haven't studied them with this model in mind. So this is where the lens analogy comes through. I just want to give you a way of thinking about philosophical problems that you've seen before and that you've read about and you've heard the discussions about, and see how this all lines up, how this way of thinking about things lines up a lot of things that you've heard and actually produces ways of generating further inquiry. So none of this is original, right? It's just sort of a way of focusing knowledge and showing the way that rational inquiry has proceeded. Certainly not this neatly, but let's try it. So ultimately what I want to claim here is that explanatory model of belief revision is something that philosophers need to learn to practice in an explicit way, okay? This is because a great deal of philosophical theorizing results from contradictions arising from sets of equally plausible claims. We need to recognize explicitly that we're not limited to simply comparing the strengths of arguments for and against the claims involved. We can also produce and evaluate theories that explain why one of the claims may appear to be true, even though it's not. Okay? So let's talk about knowledge and skepticism. Okay? This is right smack dab in the middle of, say, the Meditations. How many people have read Descartes' Meditations? We need more, right? But that's good. You know, it's quite a few of those were philosophy professors. Consider every one of these is going to be a crude characterization of the problem. Those of you who are actually historians of philosophy are going to have no use for me right now, because everything I put up here is going to be very crude and unsophisticated and unattributable to any one person and all that, okay? And I don't really, that's not my point, okay? So consider a crude version of the problem of skepticism about the external world, right? Is there can we know anything at all about the external world? That was Descartes' problem, right? Descartes was trying for the life of him to try to validate scientific inquiry, to show how, right, we could actually trust this incredible new way of making knowledge, right? But in terms of our old conception of knowledge, which required certainty, okay? So humans have knowledge of the external world, right? Descartes wanted that to be true. He was not a skeptic. He was not interested in being a skeptic. That would be a crushing defeat for him to draw that conclusion. Also, knowledge requires certainty. That was a foundational notion for rationalists at the time. Thirdly, certainty about the external world is impossible. Okay, now, Descartes didn't think that he was trying to actually demonstrate that we could have a kind of certainty about the external world, right? But this is what produces the problem, right? The possibility that, right, the fact that each of these are claims for which there are independently really strong arguments for, and we can't just, you know, we can't get rid of these by locating the bad argument, right? You with me? Okay, so what do we do? According to Randy, what we do is we try to line these things out, right? Try to line out one or the other, like a line item veto, right? But you can't just like be a dictator. I'm lining this one out. That's the solution. Thank you very much, right? You have to deal with the roar of the audience, and the roar of the hoi polloi is going to be explanatory questions. But how do you explain this then, right? That's how it's going to be every single time. Every single freaking time, that's how it's going to be, okay? So, humans have knowledge of the external world. We could discuss this a little. What's the name of the person who lines that out? Not a name of a person, but what's the name of the kind of philosopher or individual? It's the skeptic, right? The skeptic says, we do not. Maybe we just don't have knowledge of the external world, right? I'm cool with that, right? That's a skeptic is cool with that, right? Well, a philosophical skeptic doesn't really need to claim to know that one is false. That kind of undermines skepticism when they claim to have knowledge, right? Skepticism is really just what happens when you can't resolve this antinomy, right? But if we take the resolution of the antinomy seriously and employ the explanatory hypothesis, it's not difficult to see that the denial of one is not even an option. This is an interesting point, right? If you buy into what I'm saying, that rationality, right, essentially involves not only argument but explanation, then the skeptic is dead in the water. Because the skeptic owes us an explanation, but he can't give one because he's a freaking skeptic. Right? So that kind of stacks the deck against the skeptic. That's Randy's solution to the problem of skepticism. It's not a great solution necessarily. That's a very thorny issue. But that's how I would approach it. So this is because if one is false, no explanation question that arises from denying one can even be answered, right? So this is really a potent thesis. I mean, it would be a reason for objecting to my view that rationality essentially requires explanation. We'll see this problem arising with Berkeley too, right? Many people who want to just sort of sidestep the explanation question. If it's not an option to sidestep it, they're out of the game because they can't actually participate in that game, okay, given what they're trying to say. I just skipped down to three. I'll do two. You might decide that this is false. Certainty about the external world is impossible. You might say that certainty about the external world is possible, and of course, that's what Descartes wanted to establish in crude terms. He wanted to show that there was a route to certainty of a certain kind about certain kinds of things about the external world. Unlike the skeptic, Descartes did not simply infer the falsity of three from the truth of one and two. Remember, that's what most of the times we're doing, right? We're just, like, you can just infer the falsity of any of these from the truth of the others. Right? That's how it works, right? But since you can do it for every one, it's not really a very good approach, right? So unlike the skeptic, Descartes did not simply infer the falsity of three from the truth of one and two. Rather, he tried to prove that we could be certain that our sensory and intellectual faculties are reliable when used as God intended, right? Ultimately, that's the framework he was using. He tried to demonstrate independently that three was true. Now, Descartes was, I think, keenly aware of the explanatory problems associated with asserting that we can know some things with certainty. I think he understood this extremely well, right? I think patronizing Descartes is one of the dumbest things that we do in philosophy. This guy was unbelievably sophisticated. He knew exactly what he was doing, and I don't think he would be learning anything from my talk at all, okay? Indeed, one of his lasting contributions was to have developed a skeptical hypothesis, the evil demon, right, that would explain how we could feel perfectly certain about some things even though we're wrong about everything. Don't let that word explain, because I didn't underline it, pass you by, right? He was looking for the explanatory hypothesis all of the time to aid him, right, in solving this question. Descartes did not suggest this hypothesis was plausible, as you know, but he believed that it had to be ruled out if we were to believe that our subjective certainty was any real basis for genuine knowledge. And as it turns out, he could not rule it out. Descartes failed. Beautifully, wonderfully, honorably, heroically, but catastrophically, right? Finally, you could decide that knowledge doesn't require certainty. That's the last possibility. I don't mean to suggest that I've ruled out the other two. I'm just, the third one is, they all have their problems, right? But as it turns out, this is the one that's currently popular. It's overwhelmingly popular. Let's just say it's the right answer, okay? The final option is to deny that knowledge of the external world requires certainty. The main explanatory question that arises here is, how is it possible for an agent to both know that P and accept that P may be false? Now, this is getting a little bit technical, right? But this is actually the problem that arises. Explanatory questions aren't always why questions. They're all often how questions. How does that occur, and how is that fact possible? Those are also explanatory questions. So how is it possible for somebody to know that P, and also accept at the same time that it might be false? That used to strike people as very, very strange, paradoxical, and today much less so. We've developed a vocabulary according to which this actually makes quite a bit of sense. There are actually several different interesting ways of answering this question. Let's consider, I'm not giving them to you, I'm just saying that there are actually. Okay, before I stop, I want to give you just a couple more other philosophical problems. Okay, well, we got like 10 minutes? Is that okay? Okay, so let's talk about empiricism and physicalism, another problem from modern philosophy. Okay, now when I say modern, I'm not talking about now, right? You all know that would be contemporary or postmodern. But when I talk about the modern period, I'm talking about 17, 18, 1900s. Okay, not 1900s, so 1700s, 1800s. Okay, so let's consider a related problem: sensory knowledge of the physical world. Okay. So, three propositions. We have knowledge of a physical world. Our knowledge of the physical world is based on our senses, observation, experience. That's the empiricist premise. And our senses do not reveal the existence of a physical world. Okay? Now, again, if you have enough background here, that's great. But if you don't, the basic idea is this, right? Number one is just very intuitive. Most people would assert it. Number two, most people would assert, right, if they have any kind of empiricist sensibilities at all. But number three is asserted because ultimately it doesn't look like we have any actual direct experience of the physical world. It seems like all we actually have access to is our experiences and our senses, right? So you can make a very strong case. Berkeley makes this case very, very powerfully, right, that we don't know the physical world at all. And you just have very compelling both arguments and intuitions in support of both of these views. So again, how should we deal with it? What is the proper approach? By now, I think you're getting to realize this is kind of a machine, right? I mean, and I want it to be. I want this to be something that you could take home if you're interested in philosophy and feel like, yeah, I can just put this in the grinder. I might not be able to answer all these questions, but I will be able to identify all of the problems associated with any particular proposed solution because they are all going to be explanation questions that are generated from lining out one of these possibilities. Okay? So let's try number three. Perhaps the most straightforward way to resolve this contradiction is what's called direct or naive realism, which is just to deny three. Our senses do not reveal the existence.